Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 29th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Okay, one quick word before we proceed. Now, I got an email this week from what's known in Ireland as a Gaelgwar, and that means an Irish speaker who advocates the increased use of Irish in everyday language, someone who wants to keep the Irish language alive in face of the almost total surrender to English in Ireland, largely due to television and the internet and so forth and so on. Now, I have a lot of respect for these people for trying to keep one of the most ancient of the Aryan tongues alive. Back when I was there in Dublin or wherever, you would see people on the street that would be wearing a little sort of stainless steel circle called a fania, and it was kind of an invitation to come up to them on the street and speak Irish with them, just simply so people would get used to hearing the language actually used in day-to-day situations on the street. Now, this person has a bone to pick with the slogan that I use at the end of this program, which is Irish for White Freedom, and which I pronounce Sarsha Undaban. Now, he tells me that my pronunciation of the word S-A-O-I-R-S-E is incorrect, and it should be Saoirse or Saoirse or Saoirse, but never Sarsha. Well, maybe, but if that pronunciation is incorrect, then they were pronouncing it incorrectly on RTE when I was there 25 years ago, which, by the by, is entirely possible, since it was pretty clear that some of those RTE announcers and newscasters didn't really speak the language too well themselves. I very distinctly remember hearing it pronounced Sarsha by several of those men and women, whose names, unfortunately, I can't remember. It was so long ago. Now, Irish English has 32 separate dialects, one for each of the 32 counties, and it's possible for a skilled ear to detect where an Irishman or Irishwoman was born and raised from listening to their accent. And when I lived there, I got to the point where I could distinguish between about 8 of them. Dublin is obviously different from Cork and Kerry, and Belfast and Derry are different, although I could never catch it myself, and Armagh is different from just about everywhere else. I believe that the same is true in the Irish language. There are at least 4 dialects of Irish based on the old 4 kingdoms from the Bronze Age, which are Leinster, Munster, Connaught, and Ulster, and I'm sure the pronunciation is quite different as well. Now, I did look up the Irish actress Saoirse Ronan, and she apparently pronounces her name Saoirse, while the guy who wrote in complaining says that it should be Saoirse. Now, I'm going to keep it as Sarsha until I can get some kind of definitive ruling on this. I'm sure it's correct in at least some corner of Ireland because, I repeat, I most definitely heard it pronounced that way on RTE, which, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's the Irish National Broadcasting Authority. It's similar to the BBC. But if anybody really, honest to God, knows about this for sure, please get in touch.
Bye. this is Access Sally. Yesterday, I was reading a list my youngest daughter had written about the worst days of her life. It included things such as the deaths of various pets, having to move from neighborhoods she liked, and losing toys. This is a normal kid who's having a normal childhood. In a few more decades, kids will be listing things like the day the Jews came and killed their whole family if we don't get this Northwest thing going. But one item on the list caught my attention. She had listed her first spanking. First out of how many, I don't know. She probably deserved it. What surprised me was this was obviously something her father had done. I've never spanked any of my children. Not because I have anything against that, I really have no opinion on that. Some parents spank, others do not, and I trust that each family is making the right choice. What surprised me was that her father had actually stepped up and disciplined a child instead of letting her walk all over him. A point of disagreement between us had always been our disciplinary styles. He referred to me as the enforcer, and I referred to him as a whiny, girly man, though not out loud. I sometimes like to read the police reports section of the newspaper, and I've lived in large, scum-infested cities where I get to read about the kinds of things Mexicans and niggers do when they're feeling entitled or when they get bored. I've also lived in smaller, largely white towns and would laugh at the things listed in the police reports there. Things like missing tools, arguments, runaway youth, and out-of-control animals. I thought, wow, this is what happens when we get rid of the vermin? These are the worst things white people have to deal with? But in a way, this marks something even more troubling. For example, this report. A man called the police to report that a cat ran into his house, then ran back outside. Why the hell is a white man crying to the big bad police about a stupid animal in his house? Even in a place that had only one or two token niggers, white men were too timid and frightened to stand up for themselves in their own homes. They had to get the pig's guidance on what to do next. Another man reported that his teenage son called him a nasty name, then left the house. So he called the cops instead of being the man of the house and the disciplinarian of his family. I've also been hearing of more instances of teachers calling the police on children who act up in school, and I don't mean they were committing any crimes, they were doing things like being disruptive in class. Adults are so afraid to discipline children now without the government's okay. Same with marital problems. I don't believe spouses of either gender should hit one another, but I also don't think someone should call the police because their spouse yelled at them. I remember sitting outside a coffee shop one day, and this ugly woman tried to hand me her child, saying she needed to run in and get some cake, and could I watch the kid because, you know, it takes a whole village to raise a child. I guess she wasn't particularly concerned about the villager she was leaving her child with. For all she knew, I could have been some evil Nazi. Actually, no, it doesn't take a village to raise a child. It takes two parents. Two parents who aren't afraid to teach and guide and be enforcers. How many of you have watched the movie Felon? Pretty good one, because it shows how easily this could happen to any of us. A man kills someone who was breaking into his home while his family slept, then is arrested for murder and is sent to prison. He wasn't supposed to kill the guy. He was supposed to call the police. He broke the rules and decided to defend his own home and family without getting anyone's okay, and he was punished for it. I don't have a degree in child development. I'm not a certified teacher. I have no law degree. I didn't even finish high school. But I am absolutely qualified to give you the following advice. If your children are acting up, discipline them. Even if you're dumb and ugly and can barely read, I guarantee you know a lot more about what your own kid needs than anyone else does. If you're having an argument with your partner, work it out like adults. If someone breaks into your home, kill them. Kill them with an unregistered weapon if necessary. Feel free to use more force against them than they used against you. This is your home and your land. It doesn't matter what's fair. And if a cat runs into your house, stomp on it. It's a stupid little cat. You're white, therefore you don't need permission to raise your family and protect your home. Find your ancient Aryan courage before one day your kid is making a list of the worst days of his life and just has to talk about the time the immigrant scum broke in and mom and dad called the police and waited for them to show up. Okay, for some reason, a lot of listeners have been writing to me for advice on really general matters, not even on stuff that has anything to do with Northwest migration or racial awareness. Why do you think this is? Why do people consider me some kind of expert voice on random things just because I can talk on the radio?
Oh, it's the gentle, maternal way in which you tell people to go die and find things Jews like and blow them up. You're a real earth mother.
Oh, is that it? Well, maybe due to being female, a lot of the questions I get are about families and relationships. These questions fall into two categories. People wanting advice on what to do about their lame video game playing, TV watching, perpetual adolescent children, or young men who probably also play video games wanting advice about their relationships.
Actually wanting a relationship with you. How many marriage proposals have you gotten so far? I understand Gretchen the librarian's gotten a few.
Good luck, Gretchen. And not surprisingly, most of the questions are just dumb. It's like, if this is how you think in real life, no wonder your relationship is having problems. This one guy wrote to me asking for advice about his on-again, off-again girlfriend. Okay, first of all, what race are you? The fact that you even have an on-again, off-again girlfriend suggests you may not be white because that is a black behavior. Blacks waste time, waste energy, waste resources, and fumble their way through life while whites are determined, motivated, and don't dink around while their race dies. But I'll assume this particular man-child was in fact white. He wanted to know how he could tell if his girlfriend, on and off for 5 years, was the one. He said they were both 25 years old, wanted children, but he wanted to be sure that he was really in love. What a pathetic faggot. I bet he lives with his mom, too.
Now see what I mean about your empathy and your compassion?
So, for this man, retards like you are the reason the white race is dying out. We'd rather screw off our lives for 5 years instead of producing more of our own kind. That's 2 to 5 white children that will never exist because of you and your lack of concern for your own bloodline. You put your feelings of entitlement to love and happiness ahead of your race. Who are your heroes in the white nationalist movement? Think of these great men who have sacrificed so much for our race. Now imagine if their parents just weren't ready for kids or wanted to make sure they were in love first.
A lot of this comes from TV and movies because these days that's where white men and women both learn about what relationships are allegedly supposed to be like. That or they get it from god-awful self-help gurus like Dr. Phil and Dr. Ruth and, oh, God help us, Oprah, so forth and so on. And then when the real world turns out to be very different from the fantasy on the electronic screen, surprise, surprise, they get all upset and they lash out like they've been sold a bill of goods. They've been deceived. They think that it's other people's fault that real life isn't like it is on the idiot box, because isn't that how it's supposed to be? It never seems to occur to most of them that it's the TV and Hollywood that are at fault telling them lies, not the other way around.
So then this guy wanted to know how he could tell if his girlfriend really loved him. I'm guessing she doesn't if he's as much of a whiny little girl with her as he was in writing to me. But sometimes we forget one thing. When it comes to producing more of a dying species, love and happiness are not prerequisites. What you need are working parts. Is she a healthy white female of breeding age? Well, looks like she might be the one. Congratulations! If she has no interest in raising a family, then she has obviously chosen racial suicide and is not worth 5 years of your time. If you're past high school age and have been dating for a year, either get married or break up. We don't have time for you to find yourself or whatever the hell it is people do now when they drag out their courtship rituals.
Some of you know I'm a history maniac, and I personally believe that these things were in fact far better handled in the past through the custom of arranged marriages. That's the way it was done for thousands of years. In fact, I actually incorporated some of this into The Hill of the Ravens, and I'll probably bring it into Freedom Sons Volume 2 as well. Now, our ancestors in times past had a completely different view of all of these things. For one thing, the word relationship didn't exist. The word for all those thousands of years was marriage, and it had very little to do with love or sex or ego fulfillment or any of the horse shit that we think of today. Now, marriage was not just a religious sacrament, although, of course, that was an important part of it, especially in the Middle Ages and other religious periods. But it was also a business and a financial contract, a property deal in some cases, between two families, be they dukes and earls or two peasants trying to combine their half-acre plots. It was a kind of a merger of their holdings in order to create a stronger, extended family, which in those days and in old Aryan societies in the time before the welfare state was pretty much all the support system that anybody had. Now, finally, the purpose of marriage was to produce children and increase the number of productive members of the extended family. which usually meant that men, and even more so women, had to marry early in order to get full use out of her biological clock. Now, I know to us today that sounds cruel and cynical and misogynistic and hard. Yeah, well, up until about a century ago, remember, life was hard, period. And it's going to get hard again. Now, we had better start leaving all of this sentimental, politically correct crap behind us, because we are going to need the old ways in times to come.
I get a lot of questions about feminism, too, usually from women. What is a feminist? Someone in the movement called me a feminist. Does that mean I am one? Does being in the movement mean I can't have a career? People in the movement will call you all kinds of names. Doesn't necessarily mean you are what they say you are. If you haven't yet been called a Jew, informant, or non-white, you haven't been here long enough. And I guarantee every woman in this movement will at one point be called a feminist, usually by someone who is running out of things to say. Yeah, well, you're a feminist is a typical retort directed at women who are disagreeing with someone or making points that others do not want to hear, the way that, yeah, well, you're a racist is something stupid liberals say.
Problem is, of course, when they get out in the real world, a lot of these feminist women find that they don't really end up with careers. What they have is jobs, which is not quite the same thing. And, of course, that's the same way with a lot of men. Very few men or women have an actual career. They have a job that they have to go to every day in order to make ends meet and feed themselves and feed their kids and not end up living under a bridge. I view feminism as a form of sexual perversion because it literally perverts the proper relationship between the genders. Now, feminism teaches that men and women are natural enemies of some kind or adversaries, and that men, all men, are constantly engaged in this worldwide conspiracy. We're constantly out to get women and do them down and enslave them and control them and so forth and so on. Now, I don't deny that there are men like that. More than once in my own rather checkered relationship past, I have had to carry the can and clean up the mess of some son of a bitch who abused and really messed with the mind of some woman that I liked. There's no really excuse for that kind of behavior, and like I say, I'm not denying that real asshole men exist. But largely, I think in these times, it's because men have been damaged by political correctness, and their own minds and their own personalities have been twisted just by what they see on the TV and what they see on Hollywood and by the reluctance of this society to allow white men to grow up. But for women, becoming a man-hating bitch who is paranoid and suspicious of all men isn't the solution. Now, that's another way that the Jews have figured out to make sure that there are no more white babies born. Now, men and women are neither equal nor unequal. They're different. They're two halves of a whole. One is not complete without the other. Our ancestors regarded marriage as the natural state of mankind, and so it is. Men and women need one another.
Now, as for having a career, I have always believed that it's not right to waste an incredible skill. If you can earn a living doing something useful and something at which you excel, don't waste that talent. You're white, not black. But having a family is not optional, barring, of course, real medical problems that just don't allow it to happen. And I mean real problems, missing parts and all that. Don't just make up a bunch of garbage about how having a kid will make you suicidal, so therefore you shouldn't reproduce. Lots of dumb bitches, probably ugly ones too, say they'll kill themselves if they are forced to do what women are made for, and in that case, go for it. You're killing your bloodline and our race anyway. It is absolutely not normal to not want to see more of your own kind reproduced. Not one single species other than the liberal retard has a desire to see its bloodline end. I remember talking to one white man who was not racially aware. He was asking me what I had against interracial relationships, and I explained that such unions cause the death of our race. Really, they cause the death of two bloodlines. In the case of one white partner and one black partner, the resulting hybrid is neither fully white or black. He had two children, and I asked him, when you picture your grandchildren, don't you see them as being white? I believe that even if you have no dislike for other races, it's only natural to picture your descendants as resembling you. His response was that he'd never really thought about that. Never? Never thought of the fact that hundreds of years after you are gone, there could be generations upon generations of copies of you? It is absolutely not normal to have no thoughts about this, to not care one way or the other about the very existence of your own people. And here's where the feminists say, but women can be so much more than just mothers. No, not true. Women can have other roles in addition to being mothers. but there is nothing that is so much more. If everyone, male and female, put other pursuits in life first and their very existence second, we would all die out, which is what's happening now. We just plain have other things to do besides not die.
Okay, getting back to Irish stuff. I have gotten quite a few complaints in the past about my constant playing of IRA music on this show, mostly from our British listeners, telling me that there are, in fact, two sides to the conflict in the North. Yes, I know. While most of the IRA music I tend to enjoy comes from earlier times, from the War of Independence in the 1920s and before that, so forth and so on, I agree these people do have a point. And so I promised one guy that I would do a whole program of nothing but Ulster Protestant and UVF music. Now, it was harder to find than I'd thought, because while there is a body of Protestant Red Hand type music, it's not as extensive, and it's usually not as well done technically as the Provo or Green music. Because for one thing, a lot of these songs are kind of like early Skinhead albums, and they seem to have been recorded in somebody's garage. The bands and the singers are enthusiastic, but let's be honest, some of them just aren't that good, musically speaking. Now, so far as I know, there is no Protestant equivalent to the Wolf Tones. I may be wrong on that. If there is, please, someone point them out to me. A lot of the Ulster Protestant stuff I was able to find on YouTube consisted of jam sessions from pubs or Glasgow Ranger football matches, and in both cases there's a lot of background noise, cheering and yelling, raving drunks, smashing glass and furniture and so forth, and while all that may be colorful, I want people to actually be able to hear the music and understand the lyrics when I play something on here. I'm also still looking for a really, really good orange flute and drum band, and some of those bands are really good, and I like the music. I like good lambeg playing, very powerful drumming sound. But so far, all I've been able to find is live recordings made outdoors at actual 12th of July and Apprentice Boys marches in Belfast and Derry and Coleraine, places like that, which are not very good sound-wise, and once again have a lot of background music, TV commentators, yelling mobs, so forth and so on. But I was able to find a few good numbers, and here's one I picked up off YouTube. The mix isn't as good as it might be, so you might have a bit of trouble understanding the lyrics, but we'll give it a shot. The song is called King Billy's on the Wall, and it refers to the wall murals and artwork, some of which are very good, by which you can always tell which tribal neighborhood you're in anywhere in Northern Ireland. If you see big wall murals of the heroes of 1916 and the Irish tricolor in Bobby Sands, then you're in a Catholic neighborhood. And if you see Remember 1690 and Sir Edward Carson, and of course King William III, then it's Protestant. I remember some weeks ago when I described to you the old Jacobite cause and played some of the music. Well, King William of Orange was the Protestant dude who overthrew the Catholic King James II back in 1688 and who started all that mess. Now, he defeated the Jacobite forces in Ireland in 1690 when James was trying to make a comeback, and some people there are kind of stuck in a time warp in that year. There used to be an old joke when people were coming into Olivegrove Airport in Belfast. The pilot would say, well, fasten your seatbelts, we're beginning our descent into Belfast, the weather is a mile, you know, the sun is out, blah, blah, blah. Be sure to set your clocks and watches back 300 years.
There's a famous painting now that everybody knows. It stands upon a gable wall over Sandy Road. In memory of King William and brotherhood is joined. They fought for our deliverance at the Battle of the Boyne. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, there are slogans painted in red, white, and blue. They tell the Pope where he can go and what he can do. There's one big Jeb and Rice, well, that's a different class. Go stick the lower arm around and stick it up your ass. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, the next time you're an Ulster, won't you come and have a look? Stand beside that mural and have your photo too. Then put it on your mantelpiece or hang it in your hall, so that all the world can see King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1619, King Billy's on the wall.
Okay, a few weeks ago, Axis Sally did a piece on the anniversary of 9/11 that rattled the cages and woke up all the conspiratorial types. And so I suppose it's time we devoted some airtime to 9/11 and conspiracy theory in general, which is always a popular right-wing topic. We have a special guest this week, none other than Richard Bingham, 7th Earl of Lucan, a.k.a. Lucky Lucan. He's been lying doggo for a while, but he agreed to come out of retirement and rap with me about 9/11. Hi, guys. This is Harold. We're here with another guest here on Radio Free Northwest this week. We've got a gentleman from across the water from the United Kingdom with us. Our English friend here is kind of the NF's resident conspiracy theorist, and so there's a number of conspiracies that he's into. One quick thing here. I've noticed that the subject of 9/11 tends to drive our people absolutely around the twist, and it's gotten so bad that Stormfront has banned discussion in either some of their threads or all just on the whole site of any alternate theories about 9/11. I'm not quite sure what the reasoning behind that is, but I do know that 9/11 sends our people just into an apoplectic state, so maybe we can start with the great 9/11 conspiracy.
Yeah, well, the first time I was introduced to the 9/11 conspiracy was in South Carolina at the Redneck Shop. And this Klansman from South Carolina showed everybody a movie, and I don't know who took it, but it showed the plane coming into the building, and the photograph or the video was of the plane from the top of the building. So how they managed to escape, I don't know. But they have video of no windows on the plane. And if you go to another website called In Plain Sight, on that website it will show you that the plane that went into the building, the second building, was in fact a military plane because it has something military underneath it, a long, round, tubish type thing. But getting down to the most point is that the Pentagon was not hit by a plane. There's no plane wreckage on the Pentagon. What they did was they put plane wreckage after the plane was hit. That's crazy, but they had a big transport aircraft, one C-130. Afterwards, they dropped plane wreckage. Now, what happened, according to pilots for 9/11 Truth, they said a plane flew towards the building but didn't hit it. That was a decoy, trying to give people the impression that, oh, the Pentagon's being hit by a plane. They now have video. I don't know where they got it from.
You talk about the Pentagon now or the...
The Pentagon. I'm now talking about the Pentagon. Pentagon was hit by a cruise missile, and they now have, I think it's Pilots of 9/11 Truth, has the video of a missile hitting the Pentagon. And I don't know who or how it was taken. I think it was probably taken from the air by what I don't know. Who knows who blew the whistle on this one, but all the videos on the Pentagon were taken away by the FBI to try and take away any evidence that it wasn't hit by a plane.
The FBI has a habit of cleaning up these messages. It kind of reminds me of after the Kennedy assassination, how a number of witnesses and a lot of the physical evidence in the Kennedy assassination was handed over to the FBI, and a lot of the witnesses spoke to the FBI, and mysteriously they ended up dead a few months later, and so forth and so on. So the FBI does have a history of cleaning up messages of this kind from JFK to Vince Foster, and now I'm sure that they know a lot more about 9/11 than they're telling.
Yes, 9/11 allowed them to pass what's called the Patriot Act, and there is particularly one white person. Her name is Susan Lindauer, and if you look up Susan Lindauer on the website, you can find her, and she's part of the 9/11 Truth Movement now, and she was imprisoned in Texas for 2 or 3 years, but they never gave her a trial, because according to the Patriot Act, they don't have to give you a trial. They can hold you indefinitely without a trial.
Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006 are the two bad ones there. A lot of people don't know that Matt Hale was actually imprisoned under the Patriot Act.
Yeah, that's one thing people need to remember, that America is not this democracy everybody keeps thinking it is. In fact, it's a tyranny just like any other third world country, because a country that kills its own citizens, especially 3,000 which died on 9/11, and prevents the truth from getting to the public, it's not a country that is actually a democracy at all. It's a tyranny, because that's what Stalin did, and that's what tyrants do. So why does everybody seem to think, Ron Paul's going to get elected? If Ron Paul is threatening to get elected, they might execute the son of a bitch, because that's where we're at. And it looks like Ron Paul might get elected. If you remember, it was Bobby Kennedy who won the California primary, and after winning, he was executed. I don't think that he's going to be able to become president, because, in my opinion, they'll make sure he doesn't become president.
They don't even let him in the debates, at least they didn't last time. A lot of people, you know, have the mistaken idea that, you know, Ron Paul is one of us. I'm not quite sure where that comes from. He's most certainly not, but he's not racial in any way, but he is a libertarian, and I can understand why they don't want him, you know, messing up the works. It's kind of like what happened to George Wallace in 1972. Wallace was going to give Tricky Dick some competition on the right, so to speak, and he might have pulled enough votes away from Nixon to give McGovern a chance, and so at an appropriate time, a mysterious, funny little man stepped out of a crowd with a gun in his hand. This has happened so often throughout this country's history, these mysterious interventions by strange forces that no one can quite tell where they come from and, of course, never trace back to anything. That's kind of the way things are done in this society.
Yes, and people need to look at the 9/11 conspiracy as the fact that America was living in a tyranny, and we need to understand why they did that, and these kind of false flag operations are pretty standard, actually. But if you go to a 9/11 Truth website, you can find out that a lot of the things they don't want you to talk about is what they call gatekeeping. That means that they don't want you to mention the word Jew, or to mention the fact that, for example, Larry Silverstein, the owner of the 9/11 buildings, was a Jew. Only one Jew died on 9/11. They don't want you to know that. They don't want you to know that a lot of Jewish companies left the buildings. The World Trade Center before 9/11. Mm-hmm. And Susan Lindauer said that before 9/11, there was this company coming in with vans, and they were coming at 2 o'clock in the morning and leaving at about 5:30, just before other people started arriving. And this went on for several weeks before 9/11. So it does seem to suggest that they could be planting explosives into the building.
Well, planting explosives are just plain evacuating Jewish companies and all their files and their computers and their office furniture, that kind of stuff. Problem with investigating 9/11 is that any cop, when he's looking at a murder or any crime, has to look at motive, and also what is referred to in legalese as qui bono, who benefits from the crime. And the fact is that only the Jews in Israel benefited from 9/11 at all, because they achieved something which has been a long-term aim or goal of Israeli policy for generations, and that is to get an American troop presence in the Middle East, literally a physical shield around Israel, or between Israel and its main enemy, which is Iran right at the moment, to protect Israel from the consequences of its own behavior. Israel has been trying to get American boots on the ground in the Middle East almost ever since the State of Israel was founded, and with 9/11 they finally achieved it. And so that, to my mind, is a pretty good indicator of the motives behind this. And then, of course, there's the fact that big energy outfits like Halliburton and Enron got an excuse to invade the Middle East and grab all the oil.
Yeah, the other myth is that somehow the United Nations has this so-called laws against war crimes. But if these war crimes are committed by a president of the United States, nobody's going to arrest a president of the United States. And in fact, nobody ended up arresting Charles Taylor, who was responsible for all kinds of war crimes in Liberia, which is in West Africa. And generally speaking, only small countries' dictators get arrested, like Pinochet or the one in Yugoslavia. So that this whole idea that somehow the United Nations has this war crimes law, such as the International Criminal Court, is a myth, because if you understand what happened in Nuremberg after the Second World War, there was a criminal court, but again, you only get taken in for war crimes if, in fact, you're a small country that gets defeated. If you're a large country, you're not going to get arrested for war crimes. Of course, they're trying to suggest that if George Bush steps out of America and goes into, say, Canada, that since the Canadians are signatures to the International Criminal Court, they should be able to get him arrested. I doubt that the Canadians would arrest George Bush, Dick Cheney, or Rumsfeld, or any other person that's connected to this conspiracy. If you look at the Israelis that were arrested after 9/11, they all got released and sent back to Israel.
Now, that's another thing. There were Israeli intelligence agents operating in the country for weeks before 9/11, doing strange, weird things, trying to get into various military installations. There was the famous incident where about four of them were seen to be videotaping the jets crashing into the World Trade Center from a rooftop, and somebody saw them and called the cops. Cops showed up and arrested them. They found these, you know, Middle Eastern-looking guys jumping up and down, yelling and screaming and laughing and just having a gay old time in the old sense of the word. Maybe the new sense of the word as well. Anyway, but they just found these guys whooping it up, and turned out that they were not Arabs, they were Israelis. There's just too many unanswered questions about the whole 9/11 thing. For one thing, the ease with which the towers collapsed, the whole issue of who knew what and when, and above all, to me, it just is very strange that we had this one big attack on September 11th, 2001, and ever since then, we haven't had another attack. Now, there's this big, huge Arab conspiratorial organization called Al-Qaeda that's plotting to blow up America and blow up our shopping malls and blow up Six Flags and all this sort of stuff. Why have we never had even so much as one other attack that appeared to be planned? Now, there have been a couple of incidents. There was that doctor in Fort Hood that went berserk and started shooting people, but that was just obviously a case of one single Muslim who flipped out because he couldn't handle being part of a war machine that was killing his own people anymore. There have been a couple of minor cases, stupid teenage kids who allegedly tried to make car bombs, but those are pretty obviously FBI fabrications. Again, it gets back to this issue about there's supposedly this big, huge organization of cartoonish supervillains out there, Al-Qaeda, that's plotting against our freedom and plotting to blow up America and yada, yada, yada. And somehow or other, no one seems to be able to actually put a finger on any evidence that this big conspiracy even really exists. Like, for instance, the secrecy surrounding the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden. Now, you would think if this guy really was this cartoonish supervillain who was trying to destroy America, and Obama really did manage to find him and kill him, and this is something that, by the way, Bush couldn't do, you'd think that they would want to bring him home and keep his body as a trophy, get DNA samples to prove that he's dead, maybe have him stuffed and mounted so Obama can keep him in the Oval Office or something like that. But no, they allegedly kill Osama, and then they dump the body at sea? I mean, come on. I mean, what kind of idiots do they think they are? I personally question whether Al-Qaeda even exists or ever has existed. And I question whether Osama bin Laden, well, he probably existed, but he was probably just an actor that they got from Central Casting. And then when his usefulness expired, they whacked him and dumped him in the ocean.
Yes, and according to the Pakistani Prime Minister, or former Prime Minister, and she was, of course, assassinated, according to her, she said that Osama bin Laden died soon after 9/11 because he was on dialysis machines, and there's no way anybody living in a cave was going to be able to get onto dialysis and survive. But again, let me get back to Susan Lindau. Susan Lindau was a CIA agent or asset, and she said that they knew that there was going to be an attack against the Twin Towers before it happened. They went to the New York Times, but the New York Times would not publish anything about 9/11, and that's, of course, a Jewish-owned newspaper. So, again, you have this obvious knowledge that they were going to fly the planes into these buildings, and they obviously took advantage of that fact and planted explosives in the building so that they would make it into a huge tragedy, thereby getting America to do what they would be able to have, what they call a Pearl Harbor incident. And according to one of the leading people of the 9/11 truth is Griffin, and he is a theologian, and he, as it were, started to make all sorts of questions about the commission, which, if you remember, it took about 444 days to get a commission on the 9/11. It took the government that long. It only took about 9 to 10 days for the government to have an inquiry into Pearl Harbor, but took 444 days. And the people like Dick Cheney and the president did not testify in public. They testified in secret. I mean, the whole thing stinks from beginning to end. What amazes me is that so many people who claim to be Aryan, which means noble, don't behave like nobles. This is something that's not noble. Killing your own people to start a war is the sort of thing you would expect from a barbarian, not something you would expect from an Aryan. And if you remember the Downing Street memos, the person that blew the whistle on that was a sir. It wasn't Tony Blair, who's basically a criminal. He wanted everything to be hushed up. But this sir was, in fact, in charge of MI6. And he is the one that blew the whistle, because it's unacceptable to nobles to start a war by killing your own people. And where is the Aryan race when it comes to understanding that? Where is the nobility of all these people that claim to be, quote, nationalists, who don't want these truths exposed and do not belong to either the 9/11 truth movement, or are not realizing this is the big event that can, as it were, blow the whistle on the Jewish conspiracy?
And here's another Orange song for you. I remember my father used to sing this one. Yes, this is Makeham and Clancy, and they're Irishmen of the green variety, but this is the best version of this song I could find.
Thank you. Seeing as it's near the 17th of March, we're going to extend a hand to our Orange brethren. With a black spot on it. You see, in the north of Ireland, we have a bunch of fellas called orange men, and they're fellas that sell oranges. Lemons? There was this fella in our hometown, he was an orange man, and he was going with this girl. She was a Catholic. They're the bad fellas, and we're the good fellas. And they decided to get married, so they got married, and after we were married a little while, he decided he was going to become a Catholic. So he went to the priest and he took instructions for a long time, and he was baptized eventually. And he came home, but he couldn't get it through his head that he was a Catholic, and he didn't know what the hell to do about it. So he went to the priest and he said, "Now look, Father," he said, "I know I took all them instructions and you baptized me and everything, but I can't get through my head that I'm a Catholic. What'll I do about it?" So the priest says, "Well, see Norman Vincent Peale." No, he didn't say that. He said, "The only thing I can tell you to do is keep repeating to yourself, 'I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant.' Eventually it'll penetrate your thick skull that you're a Catholic, you're not a Protestant." So away he went muttering to himself, "I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant." Now, the following Friday, the priest happened to be going around and he decided to visit the newlyweds. And he went in and he got a whiff he shouldn't get in a good Catholic house on a Friday. And Mary was sitting knitting and he says to her, "Where's Sam, Mary?" "He said he's in the kitchen, Father." So he walked into the kitchen and there was Sam, and he had a huge big steak on the pan and he was scooping gravy over it and he said, "You're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout." The song is called You're a Trout, You're Not a Steak. No, it's called The Old Orange Flute. A fish. In the county Tyrone, near the town of Dungannon, where Manny's eruption, myself had a hand in, Bob Williamson lived, however betrayed, and all of us thought him a stout orange blade. On the 12th of July, as it yearly did come, Bob played with his flute to the sound of a drum. You may talk of your harp, your piano, or lute, but there's none could compare with the old orange flute. But Bob the Deceiver, he took us all in. He married a papist called Bridget McGinn, turned papish himself and forsook the old cause that gave us our freedom, religion and laws. Now the boys of the place made some comment upon it, and Bob had to fly to the province of Connaught. He fled with his wife and his fixings to boot, and along with the latter, his old orange flute. At the chapel on Sunday, to atone for past deeds, said pathers and aves and counted his beads. Till after some time, at the priest's own desire, he went with the old flute to play in the choir. He went with the old flute to play for the mass, but the instrument shivered and sighed, oh alas. And try though he would, though it made a great noise, the flute would play only the Protestant boys. Bob jumped and he started and got in a flutter, and threw the old flute in the blessed holy water. He thought that this charm would bring some other sound. When he tried it again, it played Crappie's Lie Down. And for all he would whistle and finger and blow to play Papie's music, he found it no go. Kick the Pope and boil water, it freely would sound, but one Papie squeaking, it couldn't be found. At the council of priests that was held the next day, they decided to banish the old flute away. They couldn't knock heresy out of its head, so they bought Bob a new one to play in its stead. Well, the old flute was doomed, and its fate was pathetic. 'Twas fastened and burned at the stake as heretic. As the flame soared around it, they heard a strange noise, as the old flute still whistling the Protestant voice.
Toodle-a-lee, toodle-a-lee, oh, it's 6 miles from Bangor to Donaghadee.
Time now for the fourth in the series of what I call the Brandenburg Lectures, named after the landmark 1969 Supreme Court ruling Brandenburg v. Ohio, which decreed that theoretical discussion of direct action to bring about change in this decrepit and poisonous society is constitutionally protected free speech, just so long as no one ever actually tries to change anything, in which case Americans can be arrested without trial, framed on perjured evidence, tortured, and murdered. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies and all that crap. I'm going to start this week with another one of Harold's obscure little Aryan history stories. Now, sorry if some of you find these boring, but this one has a point. The official story is that the Protestant Reformation as a whole, and the Lutheran Church in particular, began in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg, Germany. But what ensured the survival of the Reformation and of Luther's theology was an event that took place about 3 years later, if memory serves. Luther's ideas had caused all kinds of hullabaloo in the established religious world of the time, and he started getting a lot of followers, especially in Germany. And so the Catholic Church decided to pull one of their old tricks out of the bag. They summoned Martin Luther to a big meeting at some place in Germany. This might actually have been the famous Diet of Worms, I can't recall. The idea being that Luther would defend his assorted heretical ideas against the top theologians and cardinals of the church in a big debate. Now, the Pope and the Catholics didn't really care whether or not Luther won the debate, because whether he won or lost, the intention was to arrest him at the end of the conference and burn him at the stake. Now, you understand they'd already done this to a lot of reformers and so-called heretics down through the centuries who had challenged the wealth and the power of the church, going all the way back to the Albigenses and Jan Hus, and the spiritual Franciscans, and don't get me into who all those people were, or we will be here all night. Anyway, suffice to say that the church's habit of inviting people to come to Rome or someplace else to be burned for their sins was pretty well known, and you'd think people would catch on, and actually they did, but no true heretic could ever resist the opportunity to rant and rave at the Pope and the church for the record with an audience, and so mostly these poor saps just kept coming to these things, even knowing what awaited them. When Martin Luther got his invite to this little clambake, I think he pretty much knew what was scheduled for the end of the proceedings. But being your basic narcissistic fanatic, he went anyway. And I don't mean that in a bad way. A lot of history has been made by narcissistic fanatics. I should know, I'm one myself. What do you think these Brandenburg lectures are all about anyway? Okay, getting back to my long, rambling Grandpa Simpson story, Martin Luther attended the debate. He held his own in the face of the Catholic theologians and the cardinals. He made his famous Here I Stand speech, which you can look up on the internet, and then he departed unharmed. Why? Because accompanying him to the meeting were 200 of his own students from the University at Wittenberg, wearing armor and carrying swords and battle axes, and they made it clear to the Catholics that any attempt to harm or detain Martin Luther would be met with immediate and overwhelming armed force. Now that is why today there are Lutheran churches dotting the land all over America and throughout the world, as there have been for 500 years now. Not because Luther was right. Not because somebody voted for him. Not because the opposing side had any respect for free speech or dissent. Not because God was on his side. But because those 200 swords and battle axes were on his side. If not for that armed escort, Luther would have been seized and barbecued, and that would have been the end of that. But the early Lutherans understood something that modern-day Americans have forgotten, and that is that tyranny doesn't play fair. Tyranny respects no one's rights, and the only way to defeat tyranny is with armed force and the willingness to use it. I'm going to try now to speak for a whole people, my people, several generations of them, and I think our enemies who are listening to us will know that I speak the truth, and that's why they fear us. Ever since I was a child, I've always been able to detect that there is, there's a kind of stench about America. America, even back in the day, was kind of like a fish that's just been lying on the dock for a while. It wasn't quite rotten yet, but the flies were buzzing around, and if you got a whiff, you could tell it was starting to go off. Things have never really been right here for generations, actually since before I was born. As far back as the oldest people among us can recall, something's always been a little bit off. You could tell the fish was starting to turn. I'm not alone among white people of my generation in that I've always felt, almost instinctively, that there was something wrong, something off-kilter about what's been happening in this country, something defective about the way it's run and who's running it that we all knew someday was going to come to a head and cause serious major problems. I'm not just talking about the obvious stuff, all the scandals and the corruption and the thievery and the perversion and the stupidity and the pointless wars and the inflation and blah, 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 but something wrong about the kind of government and the kind of people in it and the kind of society that just seems to constantly produce all this bizarre, dysfunctional crap. A society and a way of life that somehow just never quite seems to get its act together. A society that can never really solve anything. A ruling class that always seems to be a day late and a dollar short on everything. I like to read our old right-wing and racial stuff from back in the day. I used to have quite a collection, and by the by, if anyone knows where I can get hold of some of the old duck books from the early 1980s, I'd love to read those again. Anyway, there was an almost innocent air about the way the old right-wing pundits used to constantly predict disaster, and now the disaster's here. Now, I knew a lot of guys who were around back then, and of course I remember a good deal of it myself, and I can tell you that there's always been this sense that things weren't right, even when life in America was going fairly good on the surface. It was always there, sub rosa, so to speak. I'm not just talking about right-wingers or movement people. I know that probably the overwhelming majority of white Americans over the past 50 years have had somewhere in the back of their minds this quiet and unspoken sense of unease. This sense that things weren't really going the way they should. Not entirely. I mean, after all, we won the great World War II, didn't we? We beat the evil Nazis and slaughtered their leaders and A-bombed the Japs. And then those of us who made it out alive came home, had a parade, went to college on the GI Bill, and married Cindy Lou from next door and had 2.5 kids in a tract house in a suburban development, didn't we? Now, didn't Hollywood and the politicians at the time promise us that if we'd just kill that evil Hitler fellow for the Jews, everything would be all right, a paradise on earth? And for a while in the 1950s, maybe we got a little taste of that. But then all this other crap just kept coming up. First the war in Korea that everybody knew we didn't really win and everybody tried to forget about. And then there was our refusal to face up to the whole communist thing and the media demonizing Joe McCarthy and murdering James Forrestal and a few other men within the system who tried to resist. Then there was this whole civil rights thing with niggers marching everywhere and the media crawling after Martin Luther King and licking his feet. And of course after that came Vietnam, where we allowed people like Jane Fonda and the liberals to give open aid and comfort to the enemy. Oh boy, if she'd tried that shit in World War II when we were fighting white Europeans, Jane Fonda would have been stood up against a wall and shot. And then we let the liberal media lynch an American president and hound him out of office, and all of a sudden we had Jimmy Carter as president, and things just really started going downhill. TV started getting really smutty, and those 2.5 kids we had from the tract house in the suburbs started going on drugs and turning into brainless sluts and losers who couldn't stay married and could never seem to focus on anything. Now, for a brief time in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan gave the old America a brief encore, a final bow, as it were, but it was hollow. The soul and the core of the old America was gone by then. From 1988 on, the mudslide just never stopped. Now, at long last, America's bill has come due. The balloon hasn't quite gone up, but it's floating high on its tether line, and the tether line is fraying, about to snap in two. The problems are obvious for all to see. For one thing, we got a nigger in the White House. And if you doubt that something is seriously wrong, check under the nearest highway overpass, or wherever your local Obamaville is. Or check your local long-stay motel to see how many white families are living there who a couple of years ago had split-level McMansions in the burbs. Now we've got a third-world country full of third-world immigrants and third-world living conditions. A massive drug and pornography culture. We're a second-class economic power. And the almighty dollar has become a green piece of toilet paper that can barely buy a pound of pot roast for $10. The white middle class has been destroyed, and the Brady Bunch is living under a bridge. Our children have no future, and the way things are going, our future has no children. Hell, all of you know what's going on out there. All of you listening to my voice know what a toilet the United States of America has turned into. Is this what we defeated and killed that evil guy Hitler and all those Germans for back in the day? Now, I'm not the only one to ask that question. I've known a lot of World War II veterans in my time, not just American vets, but British and South African and Canadian, who toward the end of their lives said flat out that we fought on the wrong side in that war. And I'll tell you something else. Only a small handful of people will ever hear these Brandenburg lectures. But if somehow I could reach an audience of millions with them, there are millions who would agree with me and who would support the Northwest Front. Now, today in 2011, we are living with the consequences of our failure to act over the past 70 years. And by act, I don't mean walk into a silly little booth and pull a lever, choosing which rotten piece of shit in a suit we want stealing from us in which public office. Okay, I know right-wingers and white nationalists have been screaming for years that the sky is falling and we're all about to go Mad Max, and it hasn't happened yet. In smaller countries like Greece and the UK, it's finally starting to come unglued. But in North America, this society is so huge, so complex, still so incredibly wealthy and productive that it seems to have an almost unlimited, mysterious, miraculous staying power, an incredible ability to right itself and stay afloat, even though every time it stabilizes at a lower and lower level. But let me make something clear. Things are never going to get better, and I can't even find anybody in the system itself who seriously thinks they will. From now on, the trend will always be downward. And even the liberal state-controlled media are admitting this now, when they tell us that from now on, What we see around us is the new normal, as they put it. Every year from now on, the new normal is going to get worse and worse for white people and their families. And by the way, that includes all you FBI and other law enforcement droids who are listening to this, hoping you'll find some excuse to shoot the messenger and win that little gold star on your forehead from your masters. You and your families aren't immune, you know. You have to live in this backed-up toilet like everybody else. Now, things have gone too far. The lessons of 5,000 years of human history and the disintegration of empires is repeating itself before our very eyes. Historically speaking, there is only one way this can end, and that is at the point of a gun muzzle in somebody's hands. Maybe not me, maybe not the Northwest Independence Movement, but somebody. And you know something? I think deep down, somewhere in the back of your minds, you guys know that as well as I do. There are crucial junctures in history where nations and societies become sick unto death, and they have to sweat blood in order to get better. That's just the way it is. There are critical points in the development of a nation where it is absolutely necessary that certain groups and classes of people must be permanently removed from the political and economic and cultural process because they're killing it all. And like all parasites, they have to be purged away or else the host will die. The United States of America is now at that point in its history. In our draft constitution for the Northwest American Republic, which you may read on our website at northwestfront.org if you're interested, we identify and eliminate two of those classes of people by forbidding the existence of lawyers and forbidding the existence of paid professional clergy. The old conflict between church and state will be settled for all time in the NAR. By removing those two professions alone from society, we in the Republic will avoid an infinite amount of the same kind of trouble that's plagued the United States almost since the Pilgrims landed. Some kind of revolution in this country based on armed force is a historical inevitability. It's going to happen. The thing is for us to control the process and ensure that the white man survives. It's not just a matter of pure survival, though. It's absolutely morally impermissible for these evil, evil people to continue winning all the time, keeping this horror alive. At some point, sanity has to reassert itself. At some point, human decency has to triumph over the evil arrogance of these people in Washington, D.C. Because if not, there will be nothing left for anyone. Let me ask you something. Suppose the white man did vanish from North America. What do you think would happen on this continent in the centuries that followed, overrun with niggers and mestizos who can't even feed themselves in their own countries? In whose interest is it for the American Southwest to turn into what Mexico is today and the rest of the country to turn into some weird American version of North Korea or Somalia? Okay, I suppose I better stick third music break in here before I rave on. Now, this is the best Orange Flute band I was able to find, and it's called Black Skull. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, every 12th of July and 12th of August in Ulster, during what they call the marching season, the Protestants have big parades of flute and drum bands with a bunch of old guys in bowler hats and sashes and umbrellas marching down the street, followed by all the local Protestant hoodlums, because these marches are always done right near the Catholic areas, and basically they're looking for a fight, which, the Fenian types being who they are, they usually find. Basically, twice every summer, the two tribes in Northern Ireland all come out and beat the crap out of each other and burn each other's pubs and houses down and have a great old time. And this is the music that they do it to.
Thank you.
Well, I think I've made my point over the past month, and I've said what I have to say, so I might as well wind these Brandenburg lectures up now and let our friends in the silk suits file their report with the Attorney General. I thought a lot about how I was going to close this series, presumably with some long rant or other, and then it occurred to me that I already have one ready-made, which is perfect for the occasion. Now, I don't usually sit here and read from my own novels. Now, that's a little bit too narcissistic even for me, but I'm going to make an exception in this case. This is the opening chapter of my second Northwest Independence novel, A Distant Thunder. Now, don't worry, it's short. A Distant Thunder is the story of Shane Ryan, a very old veteran of the Northwest Volunteer Army, describing the days of his youth in politically correct America at the beginning of the 21st century, and then his service with the NVA in a series of interviews with an author and journalist who's going around getting the last of the survivors to give their accounts of the Northwest War of Independence. Now, the chapter is called The Turning Wheels. At the end of the 20th century, there was a Japanese college professor named Francis Fukuyama. He wrote a long, intellectual, and très chic essay called The End of History that became quite famous. Francis Fukuyama was an intellectual whore who sold his mind for money. He was a tame academic who sucked up to the wealthy and powerful of his era, big time. He told them what they wanted to hear, and he reaped their largesse. When the blank-faced white men in the silk suits said jump, Francis Fukuyama asked, how high? When the suits said run, Francis Fukuyama asked, how far? He politely avoided the mildly disturbing term plutocracy and substituted a much more fashionable practice of publicly referring to the wealthy, corrupt, amoral, incompetent, discreetly homosexual Anglo-Zionist corporate ruling elite of the late 20th century by the grotesque name of liberal democracy. It was, of course, neither liberal nor democratic, but truth didn't matter much in those days. Fukuyama argued that liberal democracy was the final form of human government for all time to come. He claimed that the allegedly irresistible combination of liberal democracy and multinational capitalism had triumphed over all other competing systems, such as monarchy, fascism, communism, national socialism, welfare state socialism, and, of course, that nasty Islamic theocracy of the ignorant Arab peasants that persecuted poor little helpless Israel so. History was now at an end, Professor Fukuyama told the world. All that remained was to formalize that fact by taking care of a few little details and getting everybody on board and whipped into shape. Then once we got rid of all those picky little odds and ends like race and religion and culture and morality and the traditional nuclear family, in other words, once we destroyed all that makes humanity truly diverse in the non-politically correct sense of the term, then all the nations of the earth would boogie down in one great conga line onto the great worldwide Euro-American consumer plantation. There mankind would graze in the grass, dancing and singing and blowing dope and fucking anything with a pulse, bathed in the warm, soothing glow from the television. The very flow of history itself would cease, and the Garden of Eden would be reborn, but instead of a serpent in our new paradise, we'd have only Ronald McDonald. The world would henceforth and forever be benevolently ruled from the corporate boardroom by pale, unseen beings in expensive suits, while at their shoulder, for spiritual guidance, whispered the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from the Temple Schmuckel, wearing his little blue and white knitted beanie, his heart filled with the brotherhood of man and confident in his ancient Talmudic knowledge of what is best for us all. Wrong, asshole! Dead wrong. The United States of America, into which I was born, was all a lie. A cheap, shoddy, vicious, evil lie that deserved nothing but bloody death at the point of a sword. In the United States of America, if you had a white skin and a dick on you, if you had no money, then you were nothing. Get back, redneck. No one cared about you. No one would lift a finger to help you, and all you were good for was to fix the rich people's appliances and toys. You were raw material for biped swine in suits to make money for themselves off your sweat and your pain. You lived your whole life like a dog. You were beaten like a dog and you died like a dog. Well, by God, we showed those rich sons of bitches and their smart Jew lawyers and their pet monkeys that dogs have teeth. Oh, yeah. Amazing what a few well-placed bullets and a dab or two of Semtex under some rabbi's kosher tukis can do to get the wheels of history jump-started and turning back on track. My name is Shane Ryan. I was one of those little details Fukuyama and his kind never could quite take care of. I was a Northwest volunteer. This is how we started the wheels of history turning again. And that's how we will start the wheels of history turning again, if we ever decide that we would rather die on our feet than live on our knees. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the bond. Freedom. Oh, and their footsteps are rising on.